This is The Way We Connect, exploring the way we date, relate, and communicate. I'm Gwyneth Jones, or Gwen. Blaming our parents for our behaviours, insecurities, and self-esteem is not big news. Although many of us may have never considered where we get a lot of our quirks from, those of us who spend a lot of time reading up on personal development have probably come across plenty of sources that suggest that our primary caregivers, in most cases our parents, are to blame for all our worst parts. For example, the field of psychoanalysis, which was started by Sigmund Freud, introduced the idea of unmet childhood needs leading to later problems in life. For example, if we didn't get breastfed enough as a child, we might end up having an oral fixation, meaning that we might bite our nails, bite our pencils, or start smoking. At the same time, he argued that our superego, that's the little angel or nagging voice on your shoulder that tells you what's right and wrong, that you're not trying hard enough, that you're too lazy, is the internalized voice of your parents. So if your mother was always telling you that it was wrong to cheat, chances are that the little voice in your head tells you similar things too. This can be a great way of keeping us in line with society, but it can also leave many of us with anxieties and insecurities that we can trace back to comments from parents. One famous poem is This Be the Verse by Philip Larkin. If you don't know it, it goes something like this. They fuck you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with all the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by fools in old-style hats and coats who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man, it deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself. In a book whose title takes the first line of that poem, They Fuck You Up, by Oliver James, we hear about how the way we're treated the first 6 months of our lives has a massive effect on who we become later in life. Attachment theorists tell us that we might be insecure in all of our attachments because our parents weren't consistent enough, they didn't give us enough love or attention, but at the same time, a lot of people are still inspired by that older Victorian idea that we shouldn't spoil our children too much. A lot of parents fear that overindulging their children might spoil them in some way. But on the other hand, we're told that unmet needs, not getting enough love, could cause anxieties and insecurities in our children later on. So, here are two questions. Should we blame our parents for fucking us up, or is that unfair because, as the poem points out, they were fucked up too by their own parents and so on, until we all trace it back to what? And with all of these narratives surrounding how parents are supposed to behave, how they're responsible for the outcomes they see in their children, what kind of pressure is that on parents now to constantly make sure that they don't mess up their child? With all of these questions in my mind, I talked to Ami Quirikoni from the podcast One Broken Mum about all of these things and many more. Okay, so hi Ami, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and who you are?
Yeah, absolutely. So first, thank you for inviting me to be a part of your show. I really do appreciate that. I am actually a podcaster based out of the United States up in the Seattle, Washington area. And I'm a single mom with two teenagers. And I became an advocate in the last couple of years for mental health awareness, parenting, and self-improvement. As I began to discover a lot of relationships, not just through psychology, but also neuroscience, of how childhood traumas and adversities end up shaping us as adults professionally, but more importantly, that there has been a tendency through culture to pass down trauma from generation to generation, and that there's an overall kind of lack of understanding and awareness of what trauma really is and how it's perceived by the brain during brain development. And so today, like I said, I do a show where I talk with a lot of people about this, and then I weave it in together with other coaching as well as speaking opportunities of showing other people how it affects them and impacts them, again, through their businesses as well as through their professional lives. And when I'm not doing that, like I said, I've got two teenagers at home that I am actively always doing my best to help them through their life challenges as well as working on myself all the time.
Great. Okay, so can you tell me a little bit more about your podcast? Because I have listened to a few episodes, and so far the stuff I heard was really great, really in-depth stuff about trauma and the effect it has on the body. Those are some of the episodes that I listened to. Can you tell me maybe what's the main thing you're hoping to achieve from having your podcast out there?
Well, the biggest goal that I set out to, I mean, the reason why I chose a podcast, you know, a lot of people, when they realize that there is a lot of work that they need to do, you know, to heal from experiences, is they just do it in private. You know, they don't make it a big deal. They just go ahead and go to therapy, and they take their kids to therapy, and they, you know, make these changes in their lives, and they move on and you know, live happily ever after. And for me, I've always been compelled to help other people. It's been, you know, probably a part of my trauma history that I would never trade away for anything in the world. It's a part of me that I really do love and cherish. And so my intent was, as I made these startling connections myself about not just the fact that, you know, childhood adversities are terrible and they give you a bad past and a bad history, but the fact that the brain is altered by these experiences, and that this alteration of our brain is how we as adults access how we should be responding to our life around us. And I always, you know, prided myself as an intelligent woman, a very curious woman. I've spent a great deal of time learning lots of topics over the course of my life. And I thought to myself, my gosh, if I had to work so hard to pull all this together and to make this come together for me and learn all of this, I can imagine that there's other people that feel the same way. And so that internal drive for me to want to help as many people as I possibly can is why I chose to do the podcast. So it was to be able to share as I'm going through my journey and I am meeting and learning along the way, sharing that with people that might, you know, benefit from it as well. And so it's really to ideally break an intergenerational chain of, you know, I call it bad parenting, but not in a way of where I'm shaming parents or our grandparents and their parents, but just that we have a misunderstanding of what our biology is and how our neurodevelopment actually has occurred. And I want to help other families begin to stop that in their own families and break that link so that we aren't creating another generation of anxiety, depression, heart disease, interpersonal relationships and dynamics that are toxic and foul. And it's ambitious, I get it, but you know, there's always that ripple effect. You know, changing one family like my own family and changing one other family can have profound effects, you know, in our communities as we engage with people on a regular basis. And so the outcome for me is, am I able to shine a light on something that somebody didn't know before? Will it make a profound impact in their life? And if it does, well, then it's mission accomplished for me.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And obviously, it's a very noble goal. I'm really on board with trying to educate people in terms of emotional intelligence as well, and understanding, you know, their physiological reactions to trauma, difficult events. So yeah, I wanted to ask you about the title of your podcast. So you say One Broken Mom, and I'm just wondering, what made you use the word broken? Do you think it's a kind of, I don't know, a limiting word, or do you find it an empowering word to use?
That's a great question, because I have had people that, when the title came out, you know, over a year ago when I first, launched the show, you know, I remember somebody wrote me and they said, you know, Ami, you never struck me as a victim. And that's how they had interpreted the word. And my response back was, no, I never struck myself as a victim either. Like, I never felt that way. But where it comes from for me is the fact is that we spend a great deal of time due to shame and guilt and messages that are negative towards mental health awareness, and in particular around mental illnesses, because first of all, we've believed that the brain comes out of the box ready to go. And if there are any problems with the programming that we have, that was something you were simply born with. And again, that's the new emerging information that we have in neuroscience, is that that's not the case, that these deficiencies and dysregulations and emotions and all that actually come to us as children from our experiences from our caregivers. And I've always said that, you know, we live this tragedy twice. with, first of all, being children in captive environments. And it is, you are a captive when you are a kid. You can't go out on your own if you decide to, because you're just not prepared for that. But instead, you are surviving through your childhood and your experiences with your caregivers. And then as an adult, you become judged for the results of that. And when we fail to acknowledge that there are parts of us that deserve to be looked at, examined, and healed that are broken, you know, that gives us tremendous opportunity. But we have a tendency as culture to pretend that those breaks are not there, or discourage other people from sharing them. And because of the guilt and shame of thinking that I'm broken because I was born this way and I'm defective and I don't want anybody to look down on me. And so it's an empowering word for me to say, listen, I am broken, but I get to heal that which has been broken, and I get to move on in a stronger way beyond that because of acknowledging that. And so it's not a victim word, and you know, my show is not a victim type of a show at all. It is an empowerment show. And I do get their parents, you know, men and women alike, that actually come back to me and they identify with that. You know, they identify themselves as, I am also a broken dad. I am also a broken mom. But they don't tell me that in a way that says, take pity on me. They tell me that in a way of like, now that I know that, I am moving forward in my life and changing all of those things with enthusiasm and, you know, a sense of hope.
And you said you have two teenage children, right?
Yes, I do. A 14-year-old girl and a 17-year-old boy.
I'm curious how they feel about your podcast. Do they listen to it?
Well, my son doesn't listen to it, but my daughter does. And it wasn't with intention. My show is an adult show. I actually disclaimed that right at the very beginning, because we do use adult language on the show. And even though we swear in our family, it doesn't mean that, you know, I need my kids listening to it. And also the topics can be, they're adult oriented topics, meaning that the capacity and the ability to understand them requires some experience, you know, under your belt to be able to relate to it. But what I found out was, after doing it for some time, that my daughter and several of her friends and other middle schoolers were actually listening to the show. And my daughter had joked that somehow she became like the middle school therapist for everybody, because her mom does this show. And I talk about parenting, and in particular parenting with teenagers and stuff. My son thinks that it's great as well. And I'm proud of that. And to me, what it is it's modeling for them, not only how sincere I am about myself being a better woman and a better mom to them, but it's also modeling to them how we can live a life where we can truly be committed and focused on being able to help other people, and that's a good thing, and also to help ourselves along the way.
Brilliant. So would you be willing to share with us a little bit about your journey, like what brought you to where you are today?
I can summarize. I can get to it really pretty fast. I've got 47 years under my belt, so my journey is that long. But what happened was, it's actually been about 10 years ago now. I ended up in a situation with a business failure, you know, a bad business relationship to begin with. And, you know, the reasons for getting into it are a part of the journey and the story as well. You know, I chose poorly in terms of a business partner. And then in the U.S., we experienced the recession, you know, around 2008, 2009. And of course, that places just, you know, immeasurable stress on families, especially ours, because we were in the building construction industry. And so as the housing market collapsed, it placed a lot of burden on my company, which was a recycled content countertop manufacturing business that I had started and from a product I invented. So I have a tailspin in 2010, 2011, where my marriage falls apart. I'm falling apart emotionally. Motherhood becomes the thing that is the biggest stress on my life. And I'm unaware at this moment in time of the fact that I'm simply reliving the script and the model that I had been shown as a child. And so I was replaying over a story I lived through already once before and didn't understand it. And in fact, at that point in time, my husband, my kid's dad, and I, we both were sitting here going, gosh, it's like you're on a train, you can't even stop, and you're doing all the things you said you never wanted to do, and you're, you know, you're the mother you never wanted to be, you know, and both of us going, how do we stop this insanity? And didn't know how to do it. And so I ended up leaving my family, and I became a weekend parent. So in the States, you know, in a lot of cultures, when parents get divorced, the kids tend to go with mom and dad becomes the weekend parent. And in our family, because of the emotional distress I was really going through, we did the opposite of that. My husband, the kid's dad became the primary caregiver, and I became the weekend parent in order to give me that airspace that I needed. And then I lived 7 years, got into another committed intimate relationship, started up another business, and then found myself in, you know, everything falling apart again. And in this case, the kid's dad was unable emotionally to continue to be the primary caregiver. And so he asked if I would take them and take that role on. And I had decided at that point in time that I was ready to do that, that I'd had enough time to be able to say, yeah, I'm ready for this. I want my kids. That choice, however, was not what my partner at the time wanted. And so my kids ended up having to start over. I had to start over. And so the three of us had to all start over, you know, at the same time. Then the cascade just happened. Then I lost the business that I was in because my partner was also my business partner. And so that began to fall apart. And here I was standing in the middle of a road looking around and seeing that I was pretty much in the exact same position that I had been just 7 years earlier, and wisely looked and said, Ami, you are the common denominator here. You know, you are the reason that you are in this situation, that there's some levels of self-sabotage that are going on. And I became focused on trying to discover what that was. And so over the course of a few months of reading and researching and trying to interpret my world, I then had this flashbulb moment in December of 2017 where it all clicked. I mean, and it clicked like instantly that me not truly understanding and respecting how my childhood had shaped me and understanding that there were real biological reasons for the choices that I made and why I kept gravitating myself into toxic situations over and over again, I knew immediately that I had two things to do. One was heal myself as a woman, and two was to heal myself as a mother so that I didn't continue to do and pass down this trauma to my children who were already in the throes of experiencing trauma. You know, they already had the mom that left and now the dad that abandoned them. And I mean, they were in the middle of all of it. I mean, we're all knee deep in the mud. And so that right there was the experience that just, you know, I tell everybody, it literally is life changing. And that was a minute of sitting there and going, I need to do this. I, you know, and like I said, I could have done it in private, but then I realized to me, it felt so important that other families who might be doing this, just doing it because they just don't know any better, that drive, you know, for me to do that is what, you know, again, started me on this path.
There's so much that you talk about in your podcast. And one of the things maybe I want to ask you a bit more about is what you just said there, like that replaying over the script that you've been learning through your whole life. And yeah, I mean, I found, you know, most people are kind of not that conscious really, right, of how they behave and the things that they do and say. It's like they've developed their whole idea of how the world works, how relationships work, based on what they've seen in their childhoods, right? From their own parents, caregivers, from their own, you know, environment. So yeah, can you talk a bit about that, a little bit more about your experiences and what you've learned?
Yeah. Well, some of the, you know, my personal trauma history, you know, one of the things that I've said is that there are tragedy and tragic moments in it, but I don't believe, honestly, that anything to me that happened is really all that unfamiliar to many, many people. And that's what makes this important, is that trauma doesn't have to be the big traumas that we think of. And the word in itself is such a harsh word that it conjures up immediately ideas that trauma in childhood is a parent dying, or it is being sexually abused or physically abused, or being starved to death, or, you know, being literally abandoned and left, you know, in foster care, or, you know, whatever that is. And we all recognize that as legitimate traumatic experiences. But what we've learned recently is that trauma is also emotional neglect. It is the disruption of what our brains naturally do and are designed to do, which is this constant back and forth engagement between a child and their caregiver. And if a child is placed in a situation under toxic, prolonged, stressful conditions, it influences the way that the brain ends up coming together. And a lot of that brain development happens so early in our childhood, and then it becomes baked into, you know, how we actually operate, because our brains are building the operating manual, you know, the user manual for our life. And so traumas, you know, for me in particular, were around having a mother that was really emotionally immature and also not able to differentiate herself from me in a way that emotions are difficult to handle, because when you see emotions out of somebody else and you can't decide or understand that that's that person's emotions, that they have nothing to do with you and your emotions, then it becomes this sequestering. You know, we tell our kids, you know, stop crying, or you can't be angry, or you know, whatever those messages are. And that in itself is trauma, because then we don't learn how to regulate emotions. And our stress response system, which is our survival mode, and our survival system then gets really confusing signals over what's dangerous and what's not dangerous. And then as we go into adulthood, we perceive danger around us and things that might not actually be that way. And it definitely disrupts our ability to connect and relate with other people. And if you don't have that awareness that you're responding from an autopilot, you know, then you know, kind of, I say, blindly go through life, just kind of bouncing off the walls around you and thinking that's just the best it's ever going to be for you. And it's, to me, it's sad. But, you know, some people, when they start to reflect back on life and realize that, you know, a lot of the yelling, you know, in the house, a lot of the punishing tactics that parents grew up thinking that that's how you get kids to behave, is to spank them, put them in timeouts, put them in corners, use coercion and fear in order to get obedience. All of those are the small constant traumas that our little bodies go through as we grow up. And those now we know have long-term negative consequences on our lives. And they disrupt and like I said, they interfere with our relationships and keep us from having, you know, a lot of love, you know, real love in our lives.
And from what you've learned from this journey, what do you think are some of the most traumatic things that happen? Because from my understanding, it's the loss or the lack of a strong emotional connection, right? It's like the emotionally absent parent who doesn't engage with their child in any way. These little things can have huge effects.
Yeah, they do. You know, there is a pervading theory in psychology called attachment theory. And it is basically the concept that, you know, a bulk of our cognitive and emotional development occurs from having that one primary caregiver. And it's traditionally a female mother figure in our lives. It's not always that way, but it is commonly that relationship. When that caregiver is inconsistent or scary or not in tune with emotions, they don't have enough empathy to understand and recognize a different range of emotions, and their own emotional intelligence is very limited, then you have a child that is actually in a brain inside this child that's in a constant state of distress. And so that's why traumas don't have to be the big things. They can actually just be silent. You know, the serve and return process that's imperative in brain architecture and brain development, where a child puts out a serve, a request, whether that's a cry or just trying to somehow connect and engage, when it's not met consistently, with something secure, something reliable, then we end up forming these insecure attachments, you know, with our caregivers. And ultimately, it becomes that script that we then form these types of insecure attachments with people around us. Either we have a fear of abandonment and a loss of connection with other people, we always are frightened by that, or we have learned to just push back emotions and never show them because there's too much investment into showing an emotion, especially if it's not going to be regarded by another people. And, you know, there's probably, I'd say, about half the population, that's what the percentages look like, actually some have one form or another of that insecure attachment, you know, in themselves and how they actually engage with the rest of the world. And maybe half the population actually had a consistent, secure relationship with a caregiver that's given them some of the emotional and communication tools to allow them to, you know, be successful in life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, in one of our most recent podcast episodes, we were talking a bit about attachment theory, but we kind of applied it more to a dating context, you know, so how you can kind of spot your attachment style from the way that you behave with romantic partners. Did you kind of analyze yourself and figure out what attachment style you had?
Yeah, I did, because it also influences us in how we assert ourselves. And so I actually do some professional and personal development for women business owners, because there's an overwhelming amount of cultural messages that women get that actually work against them if they want to be entrepreneurs or professionals. And the attachment, not only does it, you know, relate to romantic relationships, but it also does affect us in our style as we get into the work environment, because those learned behaviors, how we interact with the people we care most about, comes out when we want to talk with our boss, you know, or engage with our coworkers or start a business and assert. And so when I've looked through, now attachments can change, you know, you could be strongly one at some point in time in your life, but you can learn how to become more secure. So I do want to say that. And so this does happen. When I go back at certain periods of life, I'm definitely anxiously attached. That's, you know, because I know in my own trauma history, I learned at a very young age when my mother had threatened to leave the whole family, you know, me, my little brother, and my biological father. And it's one of my traumatic experiences that created PTSD in me for many years as a young girl. I have a strong fear of abandonment. That fear of abandonment drives then that anxious connections with other people and that fear that someone's going to leave you. And so you do whatever it takes to maintain that connection. I did, however, have some degree of security because at some point in time in life, we ended up moving back to my mother's original hometown where my grandparents lived. And so when I wasn't getting what I needed, you know, in terms of my relationship with my mother, my grandmother was there to kind of counterbalance that. And so there's this strange mix of a bulk of being anxious, but also having a degree of security. And I think that little bit of security is what allowed me to be able to evolve and develop in the way that I did. And then the other thing that's funny, though, is that I've noticed is that when I detect strong anxiousness in somebody else, I turn on the avoidant in me, which is stiff arm, keep them away. And that's I believe, again, a learned behavior from growing up of knowing that other anxious people around me tend to try to draw off of my resources and suck me dry. And I've learned to keep them away. And so I vacillate, you know, between the three, which is typical and common depending on our relationships and who they represent in our lives. But definitely the bucket that I, you know, that I came from is the anxious bucket.
Yeah. So it's not that you just have one style that you apply to everybody, right? It's that it depends on who it is and the situation.
Absolutely. Yep.
And you were mentioning about having your grandparents there. And that brings me to something I was thinking about is they say, or there's the saying of it takes a village to raise a child, right? And that in some societies now and in the past, it was more that the whole extended family or the village was all there helping to raise the child. And, you know, now we have the situation where it's either, you know, just the two parents by themselves or a single parent by themselves. And they have all that pressure on them to kind of be perfect, you know, have that ideal connection with your kid, make sure you don't mess them up too much. So how do you think that shift in society is affecting the way that we're growing up?
Well, it definitely, there's a lot of pressure. And I know that pressure because right now I am a single mom with two kids. And there are days that I wish I had a family, you know, available to me to be able to help out because it's overwhelming. What happens then is unless, and again, you know, there's a whole heaping bucket, you know, of self-awareness here that I've learned and developed. And so if you have all that pressure mounting on top of you and you don't have an awareness that pressure's leaking into your parenting style, the long-term consequences is that, again, you are not breaking that intergenerational chain of trauma. You are simply passing it down through to your kids, and that's going to continue unless they have this, you know, awareness. So not having family around, you know, that can actually be supportive is detrimental. However, my last episode that I just published is that not everybody's family is worth having around. sometimes our families, it's best to not have them there because they are just an extension of the toxicity that's, you know, shaped you into the person that now needs to recover and heal from that. And so it can actually be an opposite impact, that having too many of the same types of people that have a negative impact on your life isn't a better situation. And too often we think that family is always good. Sometimes family is not good, and it is best to get away.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. And it's definitely quality, not quantity thing.
Exactly.
Right? It's not just like add more people and everything will be fine.
No. Right, exactly. And so, you know, the way I've balanced it in my life is definitely to make sure that I have a couple of good friends, you know, that are there in case I need it. And I do. My best friend is kind of like, she's my safety valve. If I can't get off work to go take care of my kids, that they're there. And my kid's dad's side of the family has been helpful, but they live far away. So their helpfulness is limited, you know, by location and stuff like that. But yeah, I don't want to say that uniformly this drive away from, you know, having the larger intergenerational families together is actually the root cause of, you know, problems we see in society. It is definitely the quality of the parenting. And there are some amazing parents that don't have their grandparents around that are doing a fantastic job of raising their kids because they made the choice to know that grandma and grandpa might not be the answer. They might be the problem, you know?
Yeah. So do you ever get feedback from your kids on how you're doing as a parent?
Depends on the time of day, but I do. And, you know, you don't always succeed in parenting as much as you want to. And they're teenagers. And like I said, I do a lot of tap dancing with the fact that being a trauma survivor as well as a trauma-informed parent means that I don't have this high expectation that my kids are going to be instantaneously healed and be pleasant and wonderful and happy. They have their moments, and their moments are ugly and painful, and I feel terrible, you know, that they go through them. The feedback that I get from them may not be directly, but it's when, you know, me showing up for them and letting them know that I'm here for them, that I love them, that I choose them over and over and over again is how we slowly heal. They do have said to me that, you know, that they've respected and see, you know, that despite the fact that, you know, 10 years ago, you know, I made a choice to separate and be out of their lives, you know, a lot more in order for that I have come back into it and I'm clearly putting in the work and the effort. And they do see that and recognize that, and they respect that. That doesn't mean that, you know, when you're dealing with the nuances of teenagers, that you always tell them exactly what they want to hear, and they're always happy with every decision that you make with them. And so I'm okay with that. But they have given me that feedback of mutuality and respect and love and care for, you know, each other, and they see that, and they recognize the differences, you know, in when they don't get that from other people in their lives versus getting it from me.
I'm wondering as well, if you don't mind me asking, has learning so much about, you know, the way that we pick up on things from our caregivers, the way that we're traumatized in all these other ways, has that made you feel more empathy towards, say, your own mother in the way of how she would have been affected?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and one of the dominant things and themes of One Broken Mom is, you know, not finger pointing, you know, this, that it's not about conjuring up all of this history with your family and then encouraging everybody to be angry at their parents, because that's not the case. You know, every parent in every generation did the best they could with what they knew at that time. And I definitely have always had great empathy for who she was and is as a woman. And also being able to look at the family of origin for her and go back several generations, I totally get why everything happened the way that it happened. There's no doubt about it. And there's, you know, there's no mystery there. The challenge is for people typically is how to be empathetic, but then also know that you still have to do something about it, you know, that you can understand, you know, the reasons why parenting happened to you the way that it did, but that doesn't absolve you from still really needing to do some work and some healing on it. And families are typically challenged by a person who decides to question their history, unlock their history, and call it what it was. Like, this was bad. You know, these things were not good for me during my brain development, and not do that in a way that leaves everybody feeling like they're, you know, angry at each other or upset or guilty or shameful and stuff. And so healing childhood trauma within a family dynamic is very hard to do. But there was never a doubt. And I always tell, you know, people on the show, and like I said, it's a common theme, you know, this isn't for you to have an excuse to yell at your parent, even if they were atrociously abusive to you. You know, nobody is born with the idea that they want to hurt other people. We end up hurting other people only because our brain is attempting to protect ourselves, and not that we do this ever with malice or intent, you know, that we are, you know, have this evilness in us. And so it's, to me, it is hugely important. And yes, do I still get angry about circumstances? Yeah. And it's normal, you know, it's normal to be angry of like, you know, or, resentful that, you know, gosh, how much better could my life have been if I had somebody that actually was a little bit more tuned in, you know, and was more emotionally intelligent. Yeah. But you know, is that worth living in that anger? No, it's not. It's a poison and a toxin, but it's natural to feel that way, you know, and it's normal to feel that way. And it gives you a signal of, you know, what parts of you still need some healing to do. And so, you know, I sit with the anger sometimes about certain situations because that tells me, again, where am I still broken and where can I do some repair for myself?
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say it because, you know, I feel like there's the potential for so much finger pointing. Yeah, so much like, oh, well, my parents like messed me up. And, you know, I think when some people might first figure that out, the temptation is to go to the caregivers and to kind of offload all of that emotion, right? To let them know that they messed you up. I think I tried that when I was 14 and it obviously didn't go down very well. I think I made my mom cry, so that was horrible. And, you know, I realized at that point that, yeah, obviously she was just trying her best. You know, she had no idea what she was doing either. I was her first kid. Anyway. Have you been able to communicate to any of your caregivers in some way, or has it not worked out so well?
No, and it's unfortunate. Anybody listening, if you jump into the opening episode of season two, you'll hear that what happened was is that while I started this journey, I really strengthened my walls around me from my family because like of everything that I said, I wasn't going to allow myself to be talked out of doing what it was that I wanted to do and to do it in the way that I wanted to do it, which was attack my family history, attack my trauma, and also do it to share with other people. And, you know, and I'm always, you know, I've been conscious as I've shared my story to say it in a way that is, you know, not finger pointing and shameful and things like that. But as I journeyed through my own healing by the beginning of this year, and we're in 2019, I actually was ready to have a conversation with my family. I kind of finally felt where I was away, where it wasn't as sensitive to me and triggering for me to be able to sit down. And unfortunately, what happened was, is that my mother ended up developing dementia and it's severe. And so the opportunity to actually sit down and talk with her is now gone. Like it never will happen. And so, you know, and I also had struggled with the fact that my mother's emotional intelligence was never going to really be, it was never at a place where we could have ever had the real talk, you know, anyways, but I wanted to try to do it with her. And then it was, you know, that it just evaporated, you know, it became irrelevant. I did talk with my stepdad, who's really, you know, been my main dad for, you know, most of my life. And we were able to talk, you know, about these things and go it. And he always had took this whole idea, he goes, I get it, you know. His own past is, as a child, had an awful lot of trauma in it as well. But other family members, you know, some of them have just kind of been quiet, which is pretty much the norm for my family. I mean, it was kind of like, you know, you either fell in the family line and did what everybody else did, or, you know, you didn't really talk to anybody after that. And if you weren't a part of our clan 100% all the way, then, and, you know, there was no need for you in our life. And so I've just, you know, in that regard, nothing's really changed for me.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear about your mom and as well, because that's a really difficult thing to see, I think, happen. And I mean, how do you deal with that feeling then when you have these unsaid things that you know, you want to have acknowledged? Because I think having our feelings and experience validated and heard by the person is, you know, one of those things that's a really huge part of healing, right?
It can be. Like I said, I don't think that, you know, for one, my mother fully admitted throughout her whole life she should have never been a mother. Right. I mean, she ended up in motherhood because she got pregnant when she was 18 years old. you know, and she was coerced by her family to continue with the pregnancy and not to choose to terminate it, which was, you know, her choice that she could have had back in 1972. And it set her on a path of, you know, being a mom, and she was reluctant to be a mom. And so, you know, admitting many times over the course of her life, like, I really shouldn't have ever done this, you know, that doesn't change, again, the impacts of that choice. My validation came from the fact, too, that, you know, when I was a young girl, I actually journaled and I documented my life for about 4 years. Daily. And so I, as an adult, being able to go back and reread my history again, you know, in real time, that's validation for me, you know. And I didn't ever expect, honestly, having a conversation with her would ever give me any kind of satisfaction, because she'd already said she shouldn't have done it. She wasn't qualified to do it, you know. And it's obvious, you know, it's obvious. I didn't need that type of closure. What I had really wanted from a conversation with her was a sense of being able to ease any fears that she might have had that this was about, you know, a witch hunt, you know, towards her. That's really what I wanted for her. What happened is that my mother ends up developing dementia. And I, you know, I had said and reflected on this, that what ended up happening was a sense of relief fell over me, because she's pretty much inoculated from anything anybody could actually say to her because of her disconnection now to the world. Right. And I know it's a strange thing, but there is something that says, you know, as I continue on with life and I continue sharing this journey and talking about the realities of, you know, our experiences, my mother isn't there living through it, because her response would have been and would have been guilt and shame needlessly, but she would have felt it that way. And fear. And because that's just the way her brain operated. And now that's not an issue for her. And so it's sad. I mean, obviously it's sad, but I'm not feeling the tragedy of the whole situation. I think that some people might feel, you know, of saying, oh gosh, I never got the chance. Like, no, I never did, but I did get this, you know. And it did do something pretty profound, which was my mother called, and she's not in her state of mind. So when the phone rang and I had heard the news from my dad, I ended up finally seeing her as the woman she always was, which was this was a child, you know. And now she's more so that because of the dementia. And it neutralized an awful lot of anger that I had been holding on, that she somehow was this cognizant, fully aware woman who just made these selfish, conscious choices, to know that really in her whole life she wasn't cognizant, you know. Her selfishness was all she knew. And it wasn't like she was making the decision to hurt me or anything like that. And that awareness didn't happen until the diagnosis happened. And then you were saying, like, this woman now that I have in my life is the exact same woman really as she was throughout her whole life. And how are you, you know, it let anger go. And I know that's kind of also a strange feeling, but that's what came for me out of that experience.
Yeah, no, I can kind of understand that. You know, it's like nobody, well, probably almost nobody goes out of their way to try to mess up their kid, right? Or to hurt people. But when you're in that position, it can feel like they're doing it on purpose, like they're trying to.
Well, and my mom's, you know, when you look at my mom's history, you know, and that's what I did. You know, when I got the news of her diagnosis, I sat down for like a full 24 hours and really thought about it. And it wasn't until my ex-sister-in-law had actually given me her observations. So I got to see my mom through somebody else's eyes, and they mirrored a lot of my experiences, and that helped really shape and frame my understanding, you know, and perception of my mom. And my mother always made choices to be with her family, her parents and her brothers, and she chose them over her grandchildren and her own children over and over and over again. My mom chose to do fun things and to escape, you know, through, you know, things that kids do, right? And so it was the being able to pull all that together and go, my mother really only felt safe when she was still the little sister. That was it. That was the only role she ever wanted to live and only, you know, was able to live in. And a little girl is not qualified to be a parent, never will be. And so I don't know we won't know to the extent of whether or not something was going on, you know, a little bit more deeply with her at a mental health level. We don't have the benefit of being able to retroactively go back and see if there's a diagnosis that could have been made. That's gone. That opportunity is gone. But being able to look on a past and say, gosh, I, you know, I was parented by essentially a child. And, you know, and I do recall, like, growing up that, you know, my grandmother felt more like a mother and my mother felt like more like an older sister who just wanted to go out and have a good time all the time. But that's not what I needed. I needed a mom, you know, and my little body viewed her as my mother, even though our relationship at times felt more like sisters, you know, and bickering and fighting and all that. And that had a long-term, you know, effect and impact on me looking back now.
How many people out there do you think are not in some way a little bit traumatized? Is it possible to, you know, do a perfect job?
There's no way to do a perfect job, to be honest. But you can't, I mean, day in and day out, you're not going to be a perfect parent. But what really does matter is that in the moment or shortly thereafter, you do have an opportunity to repair on an ongoing basis. And so are there people out there? Yeah, you know, there are a lot of people out there that, you know, have gone through. If you look at, again, at the attachment theory and you look at the percentages of, you know, through these longitudinal studies of families over, you know, 30 or 40 years about how many people end up in secure attachments, it's, again, it's roughly 50%. That's still a pretty large percentage of the people around us that have significant traumas in their history. And again, significant trauma isn't that they were molested or abused or whatever, but have had this dysfunction and this inconsistency in their lives, or have been in prolonged states of stress, you know, growing up with themselves, that, you know, it's one out of every two people you run into has probably got something going on in their background. Now, the real question is how many of those people know that? That's the big mystery question. But right now, I would say the bulk of the people don't know that. And so we've got a world of people bouncing off of each other that don't know that their subconscious and their autopilot could be repaired and fixed, and that their lives could be, and we could, you know, could be improved, and they could move over into the more secure and happy side of life out there. So, and that's not like a scientific, but I said, you know, looking at research and seeing where they think it is, that's what I think.
Yeah, that's the hard thing, is when you can sort of clearly see that somebody needs therapy mm-hmm. or help and they just refuse to accept it themselves, right?
Yes.
Very frustrating. So, yeah. So for those people who are listening and who, you know, have kids or are planning to have them, but they feel themselves that, you know, they're broken and that they're worried they're going to pass this on to their children, do you have, I don't know, what's your main advice for them?
Well, I'll tell you, the first thing is that if they are worried they'll do it, they have a less likely chance that they will. It is when you have no idea and no self-awareness that you will have some scripts running in your head that will put you into situations in which you may do things that are, again, a little bit of that faulty wiring, and you'll unintentionally do it. Again, self-awareness, as soon as you're aware of the possibility, you've already gone 90% of the way to making sure that it doesn't actually happen. It's really tough when you are a trauma survivor to be a parent, because it is very easy to be triggered back into the wounded inner child that's inside of you. And so it's not going to be an easy path to parent, but it is possible to be able to do that. And again, what research seems to be showing is that you can make a mistake as a parent, and then if you go back to your kid and say, hey, you know what? What happened to me at this moment was that I was feeling, and use feeling statements, you know, hey, I was feeling a little bit anxious about this, and I said something that I really didn't mean to say to you, and I'm very sorry about that. That actually can undo whatever the foul up or the mistake that you've made. And so it's entirely possible to be able to do that. And those little things actually are what creates that that high emotional EQ for your kids, and is also provides them that security that they know that they can come to you, because it develops a sense of trust and respect. Hey, listen, I know my mom isn't perfect all the time, but when she does make a mistake, she tells me that, and I value that. I respect that. I trust her. And trust is one of those things that a lot of us didn't get. And it makes it very hard going through life when you grow up either gravitating towards people that will always be untrustworthy, or not knowing that you can trust anybody. And so, again, you know, anybody that's not listening to my show, you know, is probably, you know, and I'm not saying that, you know, everybody has to listen to my show, but if you're already listening to my show and you're thinking about having kids, you definitely have taken a big leap forward in that. And so not to be afraid of continuing to move down that path.
It reminds me of that whole Dunning-Kruger effect, right? It's the people who think that they're really, really smart who often are the least intelligent or the least right. competent. And the people who think, no, I still have so much more to learn, they're usually much smarter than they think. So in that way, yep. if you're, you know, you're already quite self-aware if you're, like you said, if you're worrying about how you might mess up your kids. So that's a kind of comforting statement, I think. And yeah, having that, you know, that humility, right? So not to have this attitude of, well, I'm the parent, so I have to always maintain this facade of authority and my kids mustn't see any weakness in me, but being like, hey, I messed up, I'm sorry. And definitely, I think everyone should listen to your podcast, especially the people who are, you know, not just people who are parenting, right? But, you know, we've all been parented in some way. And so being able to understand the effects that our upbringing has had on us. So I was going to ask you maybe, yeah, do you have anyone, like, was there a writer, an author, a speaker that had a really strong impact on you? Someone that you'd kind of recommend?
Oh, gosh. Well, and I've had the pleasure of having them on as guests on One Broken Mom, because I do have a handful of them. You know, I was reading Wendy Bahari's book, Disarming the Narcissist, when the flash went off in my head that finally connected all the dots together. And I'd been reading books on top of books, you know, up until that point. But Wendy, definitely, it was her book. And I had, again, I had the extreme pleasure of ending my first season of One Broken Mom by interviewing her. And so that was huge. Another author that I've had several times, and I'll be publishing another episode with her, that wrote a really groundbreaking book is Dr. Lindsay Gibson. And she wrote a book called Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents. And she's written a follow-up book that was just published in May, which is why I had her back on. But the concept of an emotionally immature parent, it has been really life-changing for a lot of people that have been listening to my show and following my story, because we don't ever think about the fact that, again, like I said, my experience was, is recognizing the fact that what I had was I had a childlike person attempting to be a parent. And children do a lousy job of raising other children. You know, we are not wired to do that. We are wired to receive information from an adult. And so if your caregiver didn't have a lot of the emotional tools that an adult, a fully functioning adult, would have, obviously, naturally, you're going to be deficient in a lot of areas. And then the other really strong concept that, you know, again, is this the underlying traumas that we don't think of as traumas, is Dr. Janice Webb. And then she wrote a book called Running on Empty, which is about childhood emotional neglect, which goes a little bit deeper into one aspect of having emotionally immature parents, which is not getting the emotional connection, that serve and return back and forth that's appropriate or even developed at all, and how that actually ends up being long-term traumatic to a child, because we are wired to program our brains by these interactions. And when these interactions are limited and don't happen at all, it has a negative effect to us. We as kids feel anxious and depressed when we don't have that emotional connection to that caregiver the way that we should. And it's tragic, but a lot of people actually have experienced that in one form or another from their caregivers. And so I think between, you know, those three women and the books that they've written there, and again, I've been able to interview all of them on my show, which has been a blessing to me, I think are really, those are the great jumping off points that I have for people to start with.
Wonderful. Thank you. I'm going to wrap up there. So thank you so much for joining me today. I'll recommend your podcast out there for everybody who wants to tune in. I'll include some links, and including also the authors that you mentioned, in the blog post that will go along with this episode. Perfect. So, all right. Thank you.
Thank you, Gwen.
So much to think about here, but isn't it at least comforting to realize that just because you mess up once doesn't mean that you've messed up your child forever? That you can go and say, hey, you know, I messed up. From my own childhood, I really remember so many things that my parents said to me. Things that they have no recollection whatsoever of saying. But I do remember the times that they apologized, where they admitted that they'd been angry and wrong, and I do appreciate that. And maybe it's made me more forgiving of the way that people behave in general. I don't know. So what about you? Are you a parent? Are you worried about messing up your child? Or is there something valuable that you learned from your parents you want to share? Follow me at The Way We Connect. I'm on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Or come to thewaywe.org for the blog, where we'll have a lot of links and resources connected to the episode. Join me next time on The Way We Connect, and goodbye.